This is Ed.
Hey, Ed, it's Michael. How are you?
Good. Yourself?
Good, thank you.
Are you getting all ready for RSA? Or?
I just have three talks to prepare. How about you?
I don't have that many to prepare. I got four. I got to do stuff out for ISBRA.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a discussant. That's something. I'm on Joanne. But it was good seeing you in North Carolina. I thought that was very nice.
It was nice.
Hi, guys.
Hi. Let's see. Bill there?
Hello?
Bill Barnett.
There's Jennifer and Bill Barnett and me. And Ken's not going to be on. Scott, are you there?
And Sarah Jo's here.
Sarah Jo.
Mm-hmm.
Reviewer of the century. let's see, Jeff?
Yes, Jeff is here.
Sarah? Tina?
I'm here.
Adriana? Peter?
Yes, I'm here.
Peter, are you Brexit or not?
My wife and I are on opposite sides, I'm afraid. And I won't say which.
Tom and Kathy, or Tom? Dale or Bill? No, Bill's not going to be here. Dale? Ken?
He's on vacation.
Ken Warren.
Oh, sorry.
What do you mean he's on vacation? He said
those two words don't usually go together, do they?
He sent me that he was going to give a big talk in Chicago.
Yeah, but then he's on vacation.
Oh, all right. He's emailed me this morning, though, so. Does anybody have the IOSOB papyral fissure charts?
No.
Claire's not on, huh? I need those things.
Hello?
Yep.
Is that you, Ed?
It is. Dale, how are you?
I'm great. How about you?
Oh, I'm hanging in there, you know. Same old, same old.
Hi, John's in.
All right. You said
Are those different than the ones that are online?
Yeah.
Yeah, people don't go online. Scott's on now?
Scott's here, yep.
I'm assuming Kathy is retired.
I think officially it's the 30th, but yeah, she's retired.
Well, I will say that was an extremely, last Monday, I guess, University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, put on a very nice celebration of Kathy Sulick's career. And it was amazing, the number of students who came from very far away to be there and celebrate with her. It was a very moving experience, and I'm saying that in case any of my former students are listening on the phone. It was really very nice, and considering what she has accomplished in her career, she's just made an incredible contribution to the field of FASD, and that's only a part of what she's done. So it was really nice, and Michael was there, and Ken Jones, and Ken Warren, and myself.
Yes, and thank you again for coming, Ed and others who made it. Thank you.
Scott was there, gave a talk. Bill Dunty gave a talk. So she's had a wide influence. All right, so CFAF. So we have a lot of people are on vacation, so we have a relatively small attendance. And our agenda items were rather limited. So the first thing I would like to do is to kind of discuss, well, first of all, does anyone have any updates on their research projects?
I do. This is Sarah.
Sarah, all right, you're on.
We had two papers accepted.
Woohoo!
Yep.
Yay!
Exciting.
Which
yep.
ones are they?
The decision tree paper was accepted to the Journal of Pediatrics.
Nice.
And a paper on the effects of age and sex on neurocognition was accepted in ACER. So we're very proud. And Jennifer has already reminded me that I need to do my final forms. But I'm caught up with all the other ones.
That's the
yes.
item is basically people to catch up on the form. All right, so the tree paper is in, the other papers in alcohol are coming out. Any other news or any other new exciting data that someone has? All right, well, I guess we'll...
This is Scott. This is not related to alcohol, but we are finding that THC is causing doing some of the same effects that the synthetics are and that alcohol is, although more subtle, but it's causing eye and brain defects.
You also had some data on the synergistic effects, right?
We do, yeah, and I'll show that at RSA.
So, Scott, the THC effects, are they doses that one can get from a bong or
yes,
a reefer?
Yes, they are. We're actually at fairly low doses, too. And it's a dose-dependent thing, of course. But I just recently met Nora Volkow, the director of NIDA. And she was really excited about this stuff. And even though that grant, the cannabinoid grant, even though it got sort of got crapped on, she told me to resubmit it and let her know when I did, and she would help take care of it. But she thought it was really exciting. Anyway, not alcohol, but
no, I saw the. Saw some of the data, and I think it's exciting, and you know, it's one of the possibilities that I think we have to think about moving forward is other substances of abuse and their interactions.
So there's been heavy THC intake since the 60s, so I wonder if there's any epi data out there that kind of backs you up there, Scott, in terms of the human model.
I'm sorry, Scott, go ahead.
Tina Chambers has, she presented a little bit of this at our meeting in Austin, and she is looking into the, in more detail, so she can discuss better than I can, but she has some evidence to suggest that in all of those screens that Ken Jones has done over the years, that if you pull out just the marijuana alone kids, they seem to be more likely to have at least one minor malformation. But again, she's looking into that in more detail.
One of the problems with the older data is that the doses were just totally different than they are now.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I mean, Peter Freed studied Rastafarians in Jamaica.
Yeah.
Find very little of an effect.
Right.
But... you know, even though they were heavy users, the concentrations that were available were much less. So.
Yeah. Well, the PATH network has captured some information on this drug. They haven't measured biomarkers, as far as I know. You know, it's in wide use, as are methamphetamines, amongst the population that they've been looking at. The Cape Colored, so there might be some populations that we know about already that may be ones that could be looked at epidemiologically.
Scott, were you limiting when you were giving the THC to that same developmental period, or were you giving for a longer?
I was doing the same early beginning in their relation.
Mm-hmm.
Simply
so pretty, pretty select window of exposure.
Right. But that is a pretty key for some of the mechanisms for both
mm-hmm.
alcohol and the
right,
cannabinoids.
Right, right.
And, yeah.
I also want to remind people that to get Jennifer any news, we are trying to update our website so that we can include shots of it in the Google application. And there's a disparity in how much each of the PIs contributes to our news and events. And so I would like to encourage those who haven't been partaking or putting in things to get those to Jennifer. And I'm sure Jennifer will talk to you each individually about the website and how we can try to improve it and make it more useful. But it's coming together. There's a news banner across the bottom on CFAS involvement in investigator involvement in FASD. And so anything you have, please contribute to Jen. And then keep up with the publication list because we're going to need that also for the renewal. And just rely on what I have. I'm not going to have time to beg and borrow from each of you your publications and things. So.
Well, and I sent an email out last week to PIs reminding you the post-publication acceptance form is the key one because that gives us kind of the headline and can give us the little bit of details. And thank you to those who have given me some of that information. That's also what we want to be able to feed to NOFAS so that we can get the information out to the public. So.
And I want to extend my thanks to people who have put their data into the database and are above the goals that they set at the census, and you know who you are, and I want to encourage those people who have been somewhat slow and behind in their schedule, and they know who they are, to see and try to do something to remedy the situation, because I think that's something that's going to have to be factored in into the renewal, is how well a site can recruit subjects, where we get bang for the buck and where we don't. And that's a topic I'm going to touch on in a minute. So I just want to go over a few things about CFAS and what we have to do towards the renewal. So Jen or Jill, hopefully this will work. And so.
That looks like my backyard.
I don't have a backyard. See the summary of future?
Got it.
Yep.
All right.
You can expand that, can't you?
No, it's
you
full
can too.
It's full screen.
You can expand yours, Dale.
Oh, I can do mine. I see it now. Thanks.
Yeah.
All right. So this was, we saw this slide, but it's been updated a little bit about where we are. We're in our 15th year of funding, but it's the 14th year of the grant. We run out. We started our new one June 1st. Jill, did you get everybody's progress reports of things you needed from applications?
We're good.
I'm assuming that discussions are still occurring at NIAAA regarding the RFA. However, a notice of intent to publish that RFA was sent out, and there are various components of that. And we're expecting sometime this summer maybe the RFA publication. And the application due and to be reviewed late 2016, early 2017. And is that right, Dale, pretty much?
Yeah, that's the basic idea. And the summer, those announcements ought to be known to you guys.
And I was explicitly told that this is a competitive renewal, and we will not be singled out for funding that other consortium can try to develop and put in applications to compete with us. And I don't know if we're going to have that or not, but it's something that might occur, and we should be prepared for it. In some of these types of grants, when there are multiple consortium applying, they pick and choose and mix the proposals up occasionally so that get the best, the biggest bang for their buck. And so that is a possibility if other applications come in. And I hope I said that right, Dale.
Yeah, I think that's a good way of putting it. And you have the opportunity to really formulate some nice collaborative interactions that will help keep what we now see as being the consortium together. You know, the more of that collaborative interaction, I think, will do you well. And then maybe some new fresh projects or people joining in might be good for progress.
Yeah, and I know, like, with projects like ABCD and some other consortium, is that even in competing applications, if they liked a proposal from application consortium A, but consortium B did better overall, they could take that project out of application A and put it into application B.
Yeah, that goes on for center grants fairly frequently, rather than throwing away everything, finding something that might be good there.
Right.
Find a place for it. It happens.
So good scores are going to be, particularly if there are competing consortiums, good scores are going to be a necessity. Because you don't want to get beat out by another application from another consortium that gets a good score. So everyone should be aware of that. I think we're doing a pretty good job. We have two presentations at the FASD study group this year. Bill Barnett is going to talk about its data. It's not date, but accessing data from the CFAS. Hopefully that will go over well and we'll get some play on other groups wanting to look at those data and analyze it, and I think that's a good thing. And then Michael Charnas and Jeff Wozniak are doing a short presentation that Mitchell kind of originated about stamping out stigma. That's CFAS's role in the study group, plus some of the student presentations as well.
Ed, this is Bill Barnett. So our presentation's already up on the CFAS website, so thanks to Jennifer and Jill, if you guys want to look at it.
Great, thank you very much. Michael Charnas, once again, took the lead in putting together a symposium that features all CFAS investigators on genes, drugs, money, and vitamins. And I think that is that Sunday or Monday, Michael?
It's Monday evening.
Monday evening, all right. So I hope we'll have a reasonably good attendance from CFAS investigators there. I think in the past they've always gone very well. There's another one on fetal alcohol spectrum disorders on epigenetic changes, and John Hannigan and Dale Harold from ARC, who are part of CFAS, are presenting in that one.
Yeah. Bill Dunty is involved.
Rajesh.
Oh, yeah. Bill was one of the organizers. Dale's chairing it. And John's there, and Raj Miranda, who are CFAS, associated with CFAS. And then on Wednesday, there's one that was organized by Joanne Weinberg and Bill Dunty. And It's on developmental origins of adult health and disease, and I'm a discussant on that. And again, there's several players from CFAS. So just so you all know, I think we're fairly well represented within the symposiums. We also have a number of posters at RSA, and I want to commend everybody for including "and the CFAS" in the titles of these. That really helps us out, and it shows the collaboration and cooperation that goes on amongst the investigators. So I hope I didn't miss any. Jill did all this work, so I hope she didn't miss anybody. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just going to say it's very impressive. That's going to be great to see all those posters and presentations.
Yeah, and CFAS investigators have other posters. They're just not always related to CFAS or don't acknowledge CFAS. So these are the ones that we know do. And I think that that speaks loudly about our collaboration. When you look at the investigators in several different labs and different universities, that all looks really good. All right, so these are, as we move forward, here's just what I kind of broke this down, and I could be wrong about how, or other people might see it differently, but we have these three cores. We have the administrative core, which hopefully I think everyone thinks needs to continue, the dysmorphology core, the informatics core. In terms of projects, we have the 3D facial imaging project that goes along with the dysmorphology core and several other projects. We have a project based on behavior, brain, and all of those projects are multi-site projects, so that they take place at different sites around the country and in the Ukraine. Then we have the basic science component, which Kathy and now Scott have. We also have some associated projects such as Johan Everhart's going on as well. And then we have the nutrition and birth cohort study from the Ukraine. We have the educational component, which makes this like a P60 application rather than a P50 application, if you could compare them with the U's. And that's the NOFAS project. And then we have developmental projects. And we've had those every year over the last 13 or 14 years. And so what we need to kind of decide is where we're going. And one thing we can do is we can eliminate the developmental projects, because they will not be going in with our consortium. They go in as a separate application that may be associated with our consortium. But they're akin to R21 type applications, I would say. And they are applied for separately and are administered not by the administrative core as it's currently done, but by the individual's home institution. So we need to work now with what we have here. And I think we need to really start, because we're not going to have a lot of time to do this, is to really look at these projects. And we have to realize that these projects were never meant to be funded for life. These projects were never intended to just continue to go forward. We have to decide where we get the most bang for the buck, what new areas that we haven't been investigating might be primed for new projects. And these were some of the ideas that you sent to me when I asked, and I'll go through more of them in a minute, about where we should be looking. And then I think we also, at least for the administrative core and maybe some of the other projects, I think we need to think about a succession plan as we are aging out of some of these projects, or the PIs may be aging out before this thing will all be over. So what do we need to continue? And this is where we need guidance from the Science Advisory Board, people from NIAAA, and the investigators themselves. So amongst this group, the face, brain behavior, the cohort study, the basic science project, studies on genetics and informatics, nutrition, which ones seem to have maybe could find other appropriate mechanisms of funding, which ones need to continue in the CFAS to get to be able to get the project done because they utilize multiple sites, et cetera, and able to recruit subjects. What are the important areas of research that are needed to be investigated in the field of FASD? And these can be more high-risk projects, but big payoff projects. And I don't think just a lot more of the same is going to cut it this time around. So these are the topics that people wrote to me when I asked for three research areas that they thought were important outside of their own. And despite that, almost a significant number of people were unable to get outside of their own area. But we kind of put this together. So I think this idea of susceptibility and resistance factors was mentioned by a number of people in different contexts, either in terms of genetics, different environments, and various interactions with other substances, etc. But as a theme, I think it came out as identification of susceptibility and resistance. There was ideas about improving and expanding the FASD diagnosis and to try to translate some of these things. And I can tell you that the diagnosis issue, even with FAS, is very, very controversial. I don't know how many of you saw Claire Cole's paper on the different diagnostic schemes and the different rates of diagnosis using those schemes, but it's very obvious that you get different rates of this disorder depending upon how you find what this disorder is. And that's for FAS. When you get to the other stuff, the ARND, and it's just a gigantic quagmire. So I think that there needs to be some improvement in trying to figure out how do we diagnose this, and we catch the positive cases. We don't have a lot of false positives. We don't miss that many people. I think that debate's going to rage on for a while. There was some stuff about the globally directed epidemiology research, looking at ethnic and racial variability in the presentations of symptoms, details of understanding how early ethanol exposure leads to later structural defects in the nervous system and other tissues. Again, that was a recurring theme, and I think it comes up again in another slide, about looking at the long-term consequences, the health effects, the type of work that Joanne's going to be talking about, and Bill and Dale in that symposium on developmental origins of disease models. And detecting methods of early detection of ethanol exposure, establishing methods of early detection of ethanol exposure, whether through physical biomarkers or the microRNA type stuff, but things that can establish that an individual might have or was exposed to alcohol in utero. Other hot topics were direct tests of biological, behavioral, and educational interventions for children with FASD. Longitudinal studies of the clinical status, neurocognitive in children and adults with FASD. Do they improve? Do they get worse? Do they show signs of early aging? These are questions that we know nothing about. comparing the individuals with FASD and other conditions, such as ADHD, and Sarah has done some of this, and some people thought that it had more power than just focusing on the fetal alcohol spectrum disorders alone. Again, the early diagnosis of affected children so that interventions can be put into place, and then prevention of exposed pregnancies by looking at women who are at highest risk for exposing their embryo or fetus. The other topics that we got were understanding the relationship between parent report and real-time, real-life measurements of behavior. There's some data indicating that parents often have a very skewed idea of the actual performance of their child when they're given more objective tests. The relationship... Wait, Jill, you sound sad. Pep up. I'm sorry if I sound sad. I'm tired today. Looking at the 3D facial image combined with brain, and I'm not sure why we didn't add in behavior there. The inter-individual variability, again, I think that has to do with the sensitivity and the idea of what can prevent or augment, mitigate or augment this thing. And to capitalize on birth cohorts, such as the past projects, where we can get a better idea of quantity, frequency, and timing, and how that develops. And I know that PASS is starting to analyze their data now. So they're kind of the topics. And then I added this one, to use state-of-the-art mobile applications to assist us in these various projects. And I almost like to consider this as a core or part of one of the other cores. Because there was a lot of discussion in Austin at the Science Advisory Board meeting about trying to bring our work to a broader population than we can recruit at our local sites. And the way to do that is to get online. And, you know, we gained some variability because we don't have control over the diagnosis anymore, but at the same time we gain we gain power by the size of the samples that we could recruit. So I think we seriously need to consider that. And finally, this is what's being handed out at the FASD study group. It's a solicitation from me for new investigators and projects, using kind of the same mechanism that we used last time, where people are going to submit one-page proposals, and we'll then cut those down and then do five-page proposals and then cut those down again and go from there and trying to decide what makes for the best consortium. So, any questions or comments?
This is John. A couple of things came to my mind, and one of them was the, you mentioned there are associated projects, and I think that as we move forward, we got to really maintain some clarity about what the relationship is between CFAS and those associated projects. And also, you know, in the absence of having developmental pilots within the administrative core anymore, we might consider, encouraging people at least to let us know. We've come up with a mechanism for people who are going to be submitting R01s, have a mechanism within the structure of the administrative core for coordination. You know, so that would allow us to encourage people to build developmental projects either based upon the database or to expand collaborations with projects that remain within CFAS. And if we can design CFAS so that it facilitates those types of interactions, I think that might serve us well.
Yeah.
I mean, I agree, and I think, you know, the one area where we've done this is with Johann Eberhardt. You know, I consider Johann as still participating in CFAS, and even though he has an independent R01 project, I know he and Scott have been talking about putting in something. So I agree with you totally, John. I think that there's no reason why you have to have a U project to somehow be associated with CFAS. You know, yeah. And we should utilize whatever resources we can find out there to try to answer the important questions as quickly as possible.
Yep, and similarly, you know, to just having some sort of a structure within CFAS for managing those developmental projects, you know, if there are components that are going to be emancipated from CFAS and spun off to be more independent, we should have a structure for maintaining the collaborations, you know, post-emancipation as well.
Yeah. I think that's a good idea. Any other comments, concerns? Wow.
So this is Bill Barnett. I'll jump in. So for the mobile applications, I'd like to see it being driven by some kind of research outcome. I think the thing you alluded to was maybe recruitment. So if it's recruitment driven, or we have other kind of programmatic needs that's driving, or set of needs that's driving the mobile applications, I think I'll feel more comfortable about that, understanding the purpose of the mobile tech. So maybe we could have a conversation about that, or just that around.
I think that's going to be a major conversation.
I agree.
And because I know that there, for example, Sarah has this tree paper that's ideally suited for a mobile app that you could do on your phone to make decisions. At the same time, we need to recruit more subjects to answer some of these questions that we have. And we seem to have difficulty at some sites, not all sites, but in recruiting enough subjects to meet reasonable goals. And so we discussed a lot about, well, how do we open this up? I mean, the adults with FASD did a survey on health issues, and they got over 500 responses from adults who had a diagnosis of FASD. And usually FAS or partial FAS. But we would have and they did that within a less than a year period. And yet they did it all online. And if we can get numbers like that, we can deal with the variability in the diagnosis a little, you know, I think, somewhat. But I think we need a discussion on the types of projects that go into developing these mobile applications. I'd like to see things like the 3D camera. I know they're looking now at the less expensive camera, the $10,000 one, but to see if that works and take a picture, throw it online, and get a risk assessment, you know, or a probability assessment of what's the odds this individual has an FASD. Because I think that's, you know, one of the things that we need is rapid screening tools. I'm convinced that we can tell kids with FASD from other kids by dysmorphology exams and a six-hour neuropsych battery, et cetera, et cetera. But that's not feasible in the real world for screening kids and getting reasonably good diagnosis in a rapid time when your pediatrician gets to spend 20 minutes with you. So
maybe someone has the answer to my question. Is that
someone moaning on this phone?
I was getting some kind of a echo.
Getting some feedback or something.
Anyway, my question is, can a person just take a few selfie angles of themselves, and could a computational approach stitch that all together back into a three-dimensional image? Is someone on the call that...
Peter?
...would answer that?
In theory, you can do something like that, but you need to have a lot of examples to build the model to do the conversion.
Hmm.
So there are some experimental systems that do that. But, at the moment, I'm working with someone in Oxford who's combining 2D and 3D. So we're trying to see how we can, you know, this is in genetic conditions, but obviously it relates to the fetal alcohol phase. So what can we get from combining 2D and 3D, and how might one inform the other?
Right.
Well, Peter, I even think that, you know, you showed that you could get fairly good discrimination simply from a profile view.
Yeah.
I think you were at 89%. Just using profile.
Yeah.
And so as a screening tool, that's not a bad number, you know, to be able to weed out a bunch of people right away. So, you know, that type of thing. But I have no idea how people develop apps and how all that stuff works. So I don't know how difficult it is. I don't know what it would cost. I've gone online and looked at companies that develop apps, and you can hire the people to do it, and they do it. But I think that with all the universities involved here, we must have some resource that we can utilize. And I come back to when concussion was a big deal on football fields, there are now, I don't know, 4 or 5 different mobile devices that you can use on the sidelines to determine whether somebody has a concussion and should be forced to sit out. And all of that was, you know, driven by this money that presumably the NFL put in, and I don't think it was as much as they had hoped, but it was just driven by those types of concerns. And hopefully we could drive it. And, you know, I think giving someone the possibility of putting in an SBIR for any of the projects that they develop.
So, Ed, this is Tatiana. I guess the other thing is, so Phil and I did a call with Salesforce this morning, which is a company that can do a lot of this online recruiting. I think the other potential in screening large numbers of people like this, and I don't know if we feel like we'd ever want to make that promise, is the idea of interventions that could be done perhaps less intensively, but could be online potential interventions. You could be building cohorts, setting yourselves up for that as well. And I think if you're imagining something that could have broader impact, that's the kind of way you'd want to be recruiting and evaluating individuals. It limits the kinds of interventions you can do, but I think they're probably maybe more real world and more likely to be implementable, if that's a word.
I think that's a great idea. I mean, Jennifer has talked to me about that, about interventions, and one of the issues we have is interventions. We don't have the cohort large enough to do it, you know, and still have subjects left over to do anything else.
Right.
But if we could increase our recruitment and do these interventions online, we'd be in great shape.
Right, and that's where you could argue that you'd be trying to evaluate whether or not you can do any kind of an assessment. You know, what tools would you need to have available online? So part of it could be this project is a proof of principle that you can successfully do this using an online mechanism. So whether it's collecting images, you know, through like a selfie, whether it's, you know, doing computerized tests, you know, you'd have to do some people in person, some people online, and then you could say, this is sort of my ability to do this well, but this is the gain I get. With some false positives, false negatives, I'm able to build a cohort that I can then take to the next step. So you could frame it in that way, and I think it's the only way you can get numbers large enough, for example, for genetics, or potentially to do, you know, broader kinds of interventions. So that's the main reason that I think it's a really important area if it could be pulled off.
Mm-hmm. And people are motivated to be involved.
And
it's not that hard, I hate to say it. And so mm-hmm. we do a lot of stuff online, and that's partly where I have to say at the meeting, this was the part that I thought potentially could give you the greatest bang for your buck in terms of positioning you for interventions, which is what I think you really want to have long term as an outcome of this project.
It's Michael. I'm just going to second what Tatiana said. Whatever we do in apps or online interventions, is going to be a transitional state that identifies what is possible. The fact that we can put Sarah's tree onto an app or onto a website and possibly can in the next 5 years find a way to even use a smartphone-based picture to do diagnosis with some reasonable measure of sensitivity and specificity really opens doors for everything. It's a way of going from, where we are now in very limited numbers of patients to one or perhaps even two log orders more that will allow us to be able to do not only genetic research, but research on web-based interventions. I think that we should start the discussion with an understanding that there are not sufficient resources in most communities to be able to support any kind of intervention for affected children, and that one way to address that disparity is to develop online interventions that have some efficacy, and the efficacy may be gained by simply providing structure for families and communities to interact with children using evidence-based approaches that will come in part by doing these studies. So I think our problem, the problem that engendered CFAS in the first place, was small n, that everybody had a few and we didn't really have a way of studying it in a significant way that crossed cultures. And this is a way to go from modest n to adequate n, where we can study diagnosis, genetics, and interventions and at least lay the groundwork to be able to have meaningful results.
And this is though, it also leads you towards patient-driven care as well, which I think is a nice trajectory for us.
So I have to run to my car, and I'll sign back on when I get there.
All right, Michael, I think we're just about done, so if you don't get back on, don't worry about it.
Okay.
We'll see you Friday.
Yes, yeah, bye.
So I would like people to think about the ideas that we discussed moving forward, particularly about this, going to a more mobile online approach in things. And if anyone has or knows of resources of people who develop these type of things, I think Dale and Bill and I, the Science Advisory Board, have to talk about whether this is a core or whether this is some other mechanism within each project. But, there is online consent now that can be done. It can be all done HIPAA compliant. And so I think it's something that we really need to consider, and we don't have a lot of time. So those are these resources or places how this gets done, I'd appreciate knowing about them. All right. Any other comments? Concerns? Then we'll see you all hopefully in New Orleans.
Thanks. Bye.
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 Oh, Tatiana, are you there? Tatiana? Ah.